Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend 400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we're very excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I just wanted to highlight, we've had a bunch of specials on the election. We talked with Alex Avina about Trump's border policy. We talked with Stephen Cohn about what a Marco Rubio Secretary of Stateship, I guess, would look like. And we've got one coming out this weekend with Anton Yeager, taking a sort of macro view of the election, how it relates to capitalism and all those things. So please check those out. And if you haven't yet, please like, comment, and subscribe. We have a Discord that has actually really been, as the kids definitely say today, off the chain. So if you're interested in interacting with us...
Do they actually still say that?
Yeah, they say it all the time, Derek. I'm surrounded by college kids. They can't stop saying off the chain. But if you're interested in talking with us or talking about foreign policy, Discord is open to subscribers. And I really do recommend you join if you're interested. It's actually really interesting and people are smart. So after that spiel...
It occurs to me that we didn't ask Cohen if Marco Rubio can play the guitar. That was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, he's actually a bass player.
That's fantastic. Bass player. We can get a whole rhythm section of... shitty Secretary of State. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, you know, he's a true musician. All right, let's get into the news and let's talk about climate, where there have been some struggles at the COP29.
COP29. For the second year in a row, made the fascinating decision to host its annual climate change summit in a petro state. Last year, it was the UAE. This year, it's Azerbaijan. So if anything, on the ancillary aspects of petrostatism, like human rights and all those fun things that go along with that you lose, tend to lose when you're relying so heavily on fossil fuels, they've actually gone a little bit downhill from last year going to Azerbaijan. And things are not going well. It was baked into the cards that things weren't going to go well. But we've seen some, I guess, kind of morbidly funny things like the chair of the summit, the Azerbaijani official, basically pitching countries on oil and gas deals, or pitching companies on oil and gas deals while he's supposed to be hosting the climate change summit. Ilham Aliyev, the president slash dictator of Azerbaijan, during his opening remarks, talked about how oil and gas are gifts from God and they should be used. And coal, I think he might have mentioned coal, although I don't know. They tend to focus on oil and gas. But so just a lot of, cross purposes messaging coming out of the climate summit. But what's really important to note and has been reported this week is that, as you probably would have expected, the talks are not going well over the two main issues facing the summit. And as I said, this is sort of baked into the cards, but are baked into the pie. But the two main issues are obviously transitioning off of fossil fuels, but increasingly the discussion over climate change is not so much about how do we prevent it, because we're not going to prevent it. It's about what do we do for countries who are being hardest hit by climate change. And in most cases are the countries that had the least to do with getting us to this point. So to the countries of the developing world that are especially vulnerable to climate change. And there's sort of a consensus now around the idea of some kind of amelioration fund or, some pot of money that developed nations should pay into that developing countries can draw from to recover from the natural disasters, from other, from hunger crisis, famine, things that happen that go along with climate change. But nobody can agree on how much it should be. The real need here is, as the envoy from Kenya, Ali Mohammed, said this week, the real need, both in terms of the transition off of fossil fuels and support for developing nations, is in the trillions of dollars. The developed world doesn't want to pay trillions of dollars to support the developing world. So they are hashing that out and having apparently some very angry back and forth interactions, not getting very far. There are, criticisms or debates over how much should be paid, who should pay, where the money should come from, how we should regulate it or spend it. And it doesn't seem like they're making a lot of progress, which, as I say, was to be expected, because ultimately, while leaders in the developed world talk about this stuff and rhetorically acknowledge their responsibility and the need to support developing nations, both in the transition and amelioration of climate change, they don't really mean it. They don't want to spend actual money on this. They just want to say it and move on.
What a shock that the global north will do absolutely nothing to help the global south, from which it rapaciously extracted resources for centuries to deal with climate change. As they say on the internet, you love to see it. Derek, let's talk a little bit, though, about the Trump election fallout and climate.
Yeah, we can get into some of his other appointments, but I thought I'd tack this here. Basically, the New York Times reported this week on the agenda that the Trump administration is going to pursue when they get into office. And it's pretty much as bad as you would expect. They're going to staff, I think Lee Zeldin was made, named as Trump's pick to head the EPA, which you might as well just get rid of the EPA at that point. He's listening to a lot of fossil fuel guys, both people who have backgrounds in politics and people who have backgrounds in the fossil fuel industry. The plan is to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. Not that that really matters at this point anymore. The Paris Climate Agreement is pretty much dead. But essentially to go in and look at every government agency that's in any way connected to climate change or has adjusted its operations in response to climate change, and just strip that out as much as possible. So it's grim. I mean, I'm not going to, I won't champion what the Democrats have been doing because it's not enough, but this will be going backwards if it all comes to pass. And, obviously we're at a point where going backwards is could be fatal to a lot of people and to any chance of really adjusting for the United States in particular to move backwards on this is could be devastating.
Derek, I'm sure you saw my stupid line about putting the pedal to the metal into the brick wall of climate change was printed in a news article. So I'm glad that's part of the historical
record. Where did they pick this up? Jesus.
And I did it when I appeared on Sky News Australia last week. Okay. It was picked up by like MSN Australia. And then they have an image of like a helicopter. And then it's like flying into the quote brick wall of climate change under my Fuller quote. So I'm glad
I'm sure that the climate sensitive viewers of Sky News Australia were definitely receptive to that message. That's good stuff.
They didn't know what to do with me. But let's move on to Israel Palestine and shock among shocks, Derek. I just totally didn't see this happening. Biden and Blinken, blues guitarist extraordinaire, has let Israel off the hook once again.
It's really incredible. I thought they meant it this time. The U.S., as we've covered on this show, the U.S. sent a letter last month to Israel, Antony Blinken and Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, well, actually vice versa, sent a letter to the Israelis giving them 30 days to comply with a list of demands regarding humanitarian aid, lest U.S. aid, military aid to Israel be reconsidered, the approach be reconsidered. The deadline was this week, was November 13th. And as you say, shock of shocks, the Biden administration decided to declare that Israel is not really violating any U.S. law or anything to do with humanitarian aid. And we're not going to take any steps to rein in military assistance. And in fact, everything's just fine. Everything's good. All the people who are starving, that's just a natural phenomenon, I guess, that has nothing to do with any man-made interactions.
We at this time have not made an assessment that that the Israelis are in violation of U.S. law. But most importantly, we are going to continue to watch how these steps that they've taken, how they are being implemented, how that they can be continued to be expanded on. And through that, we're going to continue to assess their compliance with U.S. law.
The administration essentially championed, and I think this is all part of the three-card Monty game that they were playing with the Israelis, because this was just an election stunt, right? This was purely, we announced this a few weeks, three, four weeks before the election, so that the base, which is still angry about Gaza, will pat us on the head and not take it out on Kamala Harris. And then once the election's passed, who cares at that point? The fact that Harris lost just compounds this. Like, there's no reason for anybody in the administration to fake it at this point anymore. But the game was the Israelis did nothing. I mean, the level of aid getting into Gaza at this point is, if anything, lower than it was when they sent the letter in the first place. So they've literally gone in the opposite direction. But they did make a few announcements, like they're opening a new checkpoint. They left some token humanitarian aid into the northern part of Gaza where they're doing ethnic cleansing. A number of just kind of demonstrations. They expanded, I think, the geographical zone of the Mawasi humanitarian area, which they just bombed again today, I believe, and announced some steps to improve humanitarian response in that territory that, are obviously like down the road kinds of things that they probably will never do. But on in terms of the verifiably like measurable demands, and there were some in this letter, the one that sticks out is the administration was demanding 350 aid trucks per day being allowed into Gaza. They're nowhere near that. They've absolutely just objectively not gotten to that standard. But the administration took these minor things that the Israelis announced that, may not have come to pass yet, may never come to pass, but the Israelis at least announced it and said, look, they're responding to the letter. They're going in the right direction. We're going to stay on them. Don't worry. We're going to stay on them. This is where they really believe that everybody is an idiot. Everybody they're talking to is an idiot. We're going to stay on them to make them continue to improve the humanitarian situation. So don't you worry about that. But, there's really no need to punish them for anything. And so, we're just moving on as before.
It's disgraceful. And I genuinely think this foreign policy team is going to go down as one of the absolute worst in post-World War II American history, without exaggeration. I'm going through all of these teams in my class, and this one is really bad. Not forcing Ukraine to negotiate, and then basically abetting the Israel annihilation of Gaza, making it possible. Speaking of things getting worse, Trump appointments with regards to the Middle East seem to signal that he may support the annexation of the West Bank. Derek, tell us about it.
So the first thing to mention is not a Trump appointment, actually. It's an appointment that Netanyahu made after Trump's election. He found the perfect new ambassador to the U.S. Michael Herzog, who's been in that post, is leaving in January with the onset of the new administration. Netanyahu appointed a settlement activist, basically, a guy named Yehia Leiter. I believe, Danny, you can correct me if I'm pronouncing that badly. But he's a settler. He's a settler, like settlement activist, as I said. He is a former member of the Terrorist Jewish Defense League organization. Just a perfect appointment, I think, for a Trump administration if Netanyahu is anticipating getting a green light to do some annexations in the West Bank, maybe not of the whole thing, but maybe of some of the bigger settlements, maybe encroaching over time, maybe eventually the Jordan Valley, who knows. Then what we got out of the Trump administration was the announcement that Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, who has absolutely no background that would be relevant in any way, is going to be the ambassador to Israel under the Trump administration. Huckabee gave an interview to Israeli media on Wednesday after the announcement of his appointment, that saying that, of course, he and Trump will be open to the annexation of all or part of the West Bank. He called it Judea and Samaria, of course, because that's what people do when they talk about annexation. There's been a fever pitch of this stuff in the Israeli right, not just Netanyahu's appointment, but Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, called this week for just the full annexation of the West Bank. He's really vibrating with excitement over this. Now, the one thing that may pump the brakes a little bit on this process is that Trump really wants to get a deal done between Israel and Saudi Arabia. It's the thing that eluded him during the Abraham Accords push, and it eluded Biden, and that may be even more relevant. This is a chance for Trump to one-up Joe Biden, who couldn't get a deal done. And the Saudis, I should say Trump appointed also or announced a new Middle East envoy who, again, has no relevant background. He comes out of the Jared Kushner mode. His name is Stephen Witkoff. He is a real estate oligarch who has no background in diplomacy or Middle Eastern affairs, much like Jared. And so his appointment suggests to me that his main focus is going to be on doing deals. And the Israeli-Saudi deal is the big one, the big shark that's out there to be had. And that deal is not going to be done in an environment where the West Bank and where West Bank annexation is on the table. The Saudis can't at this point, I think, do that. Even this week, at the opening of a joint Arab League and Organization of Islamic Cooperation summit in Riyadh, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince slash de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, just lambasted the Israelis.
We call on the international community to uphold its responsibility to maintain international peace and security by immediately ending the Israeli aggression against our brothers in Palestine and Lebanon. Our countries have taken significant steps through their collective international action to condemn Israel's vicious aggression and reaffirm the centrality of the Palestinian cause.
He condemned what he called the genocide committed by Israel against the Palestinian people, called for an immediate halt to Israeli actions in Gaza and Lebanon, and for the formation of a Palestinian state. And he's taken a very public position at this point, very aggressively, against what the Israelis are doing and demanding a Palestinian state. It's going to be hard for him, at least in the near term, to walk that back or to do any kind of major splashy diplomatic deal with Israel. Under the table may be different, but any public deal with Israel, if West Bank annexation is really on the table.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Qatar leaving these ceasefire talks.
The Qatari government announced over the weekend that due to a lack of willingness and seriousness on the parts of both Hamas and the Israeli government, it is not in the Gaza ceasefire mediation business anymore, at least for the time being. You know, left the door open to kind of returning if there's a new genuine push for ceasefire. But this came after a report late last week that the Qataris had asked Hamas to basically pack up and leave Doha. Hamas, of course, has a political office in Doha. They opened it in 2011, more or less at the request of the U.S. government, which wanted Qatar to host this office so that there was a way to interact with Hamas leadership outside of Gaza. The Qataris, I think, are feeling a little bit like they've stuck their neck out to try and get a deal done, and they're getting nothing but criticism for it, especially in Washington, where you've got a lot of people, accusing them of enabling Hamas, supporting Hamas, which, they have been paying public sector salaries, or they were in Gaza. But again, that was the Israeli government's request because they thought doing that would alleviate unrest. I think they're feeling like they've gotten sold a bill of goods here, and they're getting out of the business. It is fatal, I think, to any notion that you're going to get any kind of ceasefire negotiation in the next 2 months. Not that that was a big possibility anyway, but to have the Qataris step back is a real blow to whatever hopes might have still been there.
Speaking of ceasefires, let's talk about the ceasefire that Israel is supposedly negotiating as a quote-unquote gift for President-elect Donald John Trump.
Another brilliant move by the Biden foreign policy team to back these people to the hilt when they were agitating, working as hard as they could to get Donald Trump returned to the White House. The Washington Post reported this on Wednesday that Ron Dermer, who's a close Netanyahu advisor and the Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, went to Mar-a-Lago and paid homage to the president-elect and to Jared Kushner and told them that the Israeli government is, I'm quoting here, rushing to advance a ceasefire deal in Lebanon so as to give Trump what he called, or what the piece calls, an early foreign policy win. So, it's not so much a negotiation, I think, as they're going to make a proposal. They're just going to put it on the table on January 20th. Like, we're ready to stop what we're doing in Lebanon, which indicates that all the killing and destruction that they are going to do over the next 2 months plus a week, as they will continue to do, as they continue to do today, is just for show, basically. People are dying for no reason, not that there was a reason before, but they clearly feel like they're ready to stop doing this if they're making this kind of offer to Trump. And yet, they're going to keep blowing the shit out of the country for two more months just because. As I say,
at Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for $100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get $100 off a cocktail maker when you spend $400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's bartesian.com/cocktail.
It's going to be a proposal. I don't think it's going to be a negotiation. They will propose something along the lines of the relevant UN resolutions, UN Security Council 1701 from 2006, that Hezbollah has to withdraw its forces north of the Litani River, and UN peacekeepers have to come in and have an increased power to enforce the terms of the ceasefire and kind of patrol the border area, and who knows what else they may demand, some extra things that aren't in 1701. But the worst case scenario for them is that Hezbollah rejects whatever they put on the table, in which case they've tried, and they can say to Trump, we tried to give you this big win, and just go back to doing or continue doing what they're already doing. I think the real losers here obviously are the Lebanese people and the Biden administration, which bent over backwards to accommodate every impulse of an Israeli government led by people who just hate their guts and have been, doing nothing but trying to ensure that Donald Trump would be returned to power. So just bang up job on their part. To real great read of the situation, just brilliant stuff all around.
Brilliant stuff all around. You love to see it. Let's move over to China, where Xi and Biden are going to meet. What do you think it's like for Xi to meet with fucking Wednesday. Biden? I mean, it must be, it's like, Jesus, it's like this like super powerful leader who's like reaffirming his state's natural position in the world, meeting with decrepit, senescent.
I mean, what do you think it's like for Europeans who don't have any fucking defense budget and depend on the United States that this doddering man goes over there to a NATO summit and they have to, this is like, Jesus, this is the guy we're relying on to protect us. Okay.
Like his creaking face, like smile and rigor mortis smile moving from side to side. You all just.
At least she can take some glory out of the slow collapse in the American
yeah,
state,
that's true. But, at least it's fun for him.
But the allies have to be like, oh my God, what are we doing here?
So let's talk about this.
Yeah, but yeah. This was Jake Sullivan, another crack member of a crack foreign policy team, the National Security Advisor, told reporters on Wednesday, and this has been expected, so it's not a surprise that Biden and Xi will meet on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Peru over the weekend. This will, one assumes, be their last in-person encounter before Biden shuffles off into whatever he's going to do for the rest of his life. Get on with the rest of his life, as Chuck Noll used to say. Get on with his life's work, sorry, as Chuck Noll used to say. It's you know, unclear what they're going to talk about or what they expect to achieve, given that anything that Biden agrees to can be unagreed by Donald Trump in 2 months and just undone. So I wouldn't expect any major things to come of this. They'll probably just have a nice little chat and Biden will go into some rambling story about how he ate ice cream once as a 16-year-old and she will just sit there and take it, because again, what else can you do in that situation? So that's probably just for show. We'll see, I guess, but I wouldn't expect anything major to come from it.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Japan and this confirmation vote that just took place.
As we covered on the show, the Japanese ruling coalition, the Liberal Democratic Party and Komeito, lost its parliamentary majority in snap elections late last month. On Monday, the prime minister, the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party and the prime minister, Ishiba Shigeru, had to put his now minority government to a parliamentary confirmation vote and survived. I think it took two rounds of voting, which just stresses how weak his position is at this point. He will remain on as prime minister. Apparently, he's evinced no indication that he's going to resign over the election results or that there's going to be a shakeup at the LDP. But what's going to happen now is the coalition to pass anything, and the first thing on the agenda is apparently a supplementary budget. They are going to need to negotiate heavily with some of the smaller parties in the Japanese House of Representatives to get anything done. For the budget, it sounds like they're going to work with the Democratic Party for the people. Moving forward, it may be an ad hoc thing. I mean, DPP may be their main go-to for support, or they may do a sort of pick and choose thing where, depending on the legislation, they look around to whatever party. It's a very weak situation for the government to be in, and I wonder how long it's going to last if the LDP sees any kind of improvement in polling. And of course, the party has been hit by scandals, corruption scandals in particular. Inflation, as it's been everywhere, is economic challenges are a problem for incumbent parties. But if its polling improves at all, I would imagine he would move quickly to some sort of new snap election to try and regain majority. But we'll see.
In a depressing story, can you tell us a little about this death toll in the Sudan war?
There's a new report that just was released on Thursday. I've just seen reporting on it before we recorded. From the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine's Sudan Research Group that suggests that the death toll in Sudan is much higher, like much, much higher than it's been previously reported. The UN and aid agencies have been bandying around an estimate of around 20,000 people dead. They acknowledge that that's inadequate. That's just the best they could do under the circumstances to try and give a accounting of confirmed deaths. But I don't think anybody has been thinking about it in the terms that were laid out in this report, which estimates that over 61,000 people have died just in Khartoum and its surrounding state, compared again to 20,000 for the whole country, which is the UN's estimate. Around 26,000, they say, killed as a direct consequence of the conflict between the Sudanese military and the rapid support forces, the rest killed by ancillary effects, disease, starvation, the degradation of infrastructure and what that means, the lack of humanitarian aid. But that's just in one state. And the estimate, their estimate is that 90% of the deaths in Khartoum have gone unrecorded. Can be replicated in other parts of the country, and certainly in places like Darfur that have been especially hard hit, Jazeera State, where the RSF is still massacring people on an almost daily basis. If that can be replicated in other parts of the country, then the death toll is just going to be astronomic here, and worse, I think, than even some of the worst case figures or scenarios that have been considered up to this point.
And in further grim news, Derek, tell us about Russia, which seems to be pushing to retake Kursk.
The New York Times reported this, and it's become, I guess, accepted at this point that the Russians have amassed an army of around 50,000 soldiers in Kursk to retake that. The territory that Ukraine still holds on the Russian side of the border.
Ukraine says at least 6 people were killed after the latest series of airstrikes by Russia. This after a weekend that saw the biggest exchange of drones between Russia and Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion nearly 3 years ago.
It's unclear how well-equipped or well-trained this force is. They may be counting on sheer numbers to eventually dislodge the Ukrainians. These thousands of North Korean soldiers that are in Russia are reportedly part of this force. It doesn't draw notably, at least according to the Times, does not draw any major assets or significant number of soldiers out of Ukraine, which is one of the one of the ideas behind Ukraine invading Russia in the first place was that it would force the Russians to redeploy some of their heavier forces, better trained, better equipped, out of Ukraine to deal with it. And they haven't; they don't seem to have done that. This is probably more of a conscript army. And again, I don't know how well equipped they are if the Russians just expect to kind of run them in a wave against the Ukrainian line. They've reportedly taken some heavy casualties, or at least the Ukrainian military is claiming that they've taken some heavy casualties. There was an estimate that they offered, that was reported by The Independent earlier this week, that the Russians had taken somewhere around 3,500 casualties just over 2 days on Sunday and Monday. There's no breakdown in terms of dead versus wounded or captured. But it's a shocking rate no matter what. Despite that, there were some indications that the Russians had made territorial gains in their operations so far. I haven't seen any indication of a breakthrough or any major territorial gains, but it seems like this is still developing.
Really smart for the administration not to push for negotiations in 2022. Great job, Jake Sullivan. Great job, Blinken. Let's talk about this new flexibility from Europeans on the Ukraine idea of land for peace.
The Washington Post reported this on Wednesday that basically, there is a new acknowledgement, I guess, among European diplomats, and it hasn't necessarily filtered out to public statements or up to the leadership level yet, but sort of an awareness that ending this conflict is going to require trading Ukrainian land for a peace deal or at least a ceasefire deal. The Post said it interviewed 10 current and former European and NATO diplomats who all kind of said that behind closed doors, the discussions are starting to focus on what kind of deal could be done here that would leave some territory in Russian hands. Under what conditions, I don't know. Whether it would be acknowledged as annexed, or there would be some sort of new internationally supervised secession vote or secession process, or they would just say, you know, we don't recognize this formally, but it's just the way things are. It's a fact on the ground. I don't know. I don't know what form that would take, but there does seem to be increasing openness to the idea of that ending this conflict is going to require, you're not going to get back, in other words, to the 2014 borders with Crimea and the Donbass and all these other territories back in Ukrainian hands. This is happening, obviously, in the backdrop of the Trump election. Trump has been very forthright about his saying that he would end the war within a matter of hours, I think, after taking power. How he would do that, I don't know. The Post also reported over the weekend that Trump and Putin had spoken by phone. The Russian government is rejecting this, but supposedly Trump advised Putin not to escalate the war in Ukraine over the next couple of months, because I guess there's a good deal waiting for him at the end when Trump is actually back in the White House. But as I say, the Russians denied there's been any conversation like that that's taken place.
Let's stay in Europe and let's talk about these snap German elections that are going to be held in February.
We talked last week about the collapse of Germany's governing coalition. The Social Democratic Party basically booted the Free Democratic Party out of the three-party coalition. Olaf Scholz fired Christian Lindner, the leader of the FDP, who was his finance minister, over an internal discord about next year's budget. Scholz announced this week that Germany will hold a snap election, that he's going to his plan had been to call for a no confidence vote in parliament in January, that his government now, which is a minority government, just the SDP and the Greens, would have lost. And then there would have been on the timetable that he had laid out would have been an election in March. He announced this week that the process is going to be moved up by about a month. He's going to ask for the confidence vote in December, and the snap election will take place in February, on February 23rd. This is after negotiations between the SDP and the main opposition, the Christian Democratic Union, Christian Social Union Alliance, which had wanted a vote immediately and then an election in January. Scholz had wanted March, and they compromised on February. So that's the plan. As I say, the SDP will lose that confidence vote. There will be an election. The CDU-CSU is expected to win. Polling indicates that it will win, but it's going to need support at least from the SDP, if not from the SDP plus another party, in order to govern, to have a majority in the parliament. And of course, everybody's concerned about how the far-right Alternative for Germany party may do. That party has been surging in state elections, and polling indicates that it's could wind up in second place, at least behind CDU-CSU. So it could be a formidable player in the snap election.
Let's talk about Haiti and this transitional council, which has fired the prime minister.
This happened on Sunday. The transitional council announced that it was firing Prime Minister Gary Conille, and it replaced him with a businessman named Alex Didier Fils Aimé. I know I'm mangling that. Sorry. But the genesis of this seems to be the justification, I think, is that the security situation, you know, Conille hasn't improved the security situation really, or anything else about Haiti since he took office. But the real genesis of this appears to be a corruption scandal within the transitional council that has ensnared three of its members for taking bribes, I believe, coincidentally or not, all three of the council members who are ensnared in this corruption scandal voted to get rid of Conille. So I think there's probably some correlation there. There was some question as to whether Conille would put up a fight here and whether the transitional council actually had the authority to fire a prime minister. That power in normal times rests solely with the Haitian parliament, but of course Haiti doesn't have a parliament or really even an elected government to speak of. It's unclear where the lines were, but Conille has since kind of acceded to his resignation. He's not challenging it, so this is a done deal. The other bit of news this week, Danny, that I know we were going to get to, is that the U.S. announced that it is suspending all direct flights from the U.S. to Haiti after a Spirit Airlines flight that was trying to land at Toussaint-Louverture International Airport at Port-au-Prince came under fire from ostensibly, at least from gang militants. There were bullet holes in the plane as it was trying to land, and it immediately diverted to the Dominican Republic. Two more U.S. Aircraft, I think one from, American Airlines was one, and JetBlue was the other, found evidence that their planes that were taking off from that same airport on Monday, this all happened on Monday, that they had taken fire while taking off. Like in a post-flight inspection, they found, again, bullet holes in the fuselage of these planes. And so the U.S. has banned all flights for at least the next 30 days direct to and from, I guess, Haiti.
That's wild. Imagine getting on a plane and finding out when you land there were bullet holes in it.
Somebody shot. Jesus Christ. That's a little bit much, right?
Let's end on the all-star team that Trump is appointing to lead our beautiful, glorious nation further into the 21st century. Derek, tell us about Trump's foreign policy appointments.
Yeah, I just thought we'd mention them. I don't know, you know, how much we want to get into it. But of course, you mentioned Rubio as Secretary of State. You mentioned we mentioned Mike Huckabee as new ambassador to Israel. There are other appointments. Mike Waltz, representative from Florida, is apparently on tap to serve as national security advisor. Elise Stefanik from New York, congresswoman, is on tap to become ambassador to the U.N. John Ratcliffe, who was Trump's director of national intelligence, is going to run the CIA. Tulsi Gabbard, the former Democratic representative turned MAGA stalwart, is going to be director of national intelligence. Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, is being appointed or nominated for Secretary of Homeland Security. Matt Gaetz, congressman from Florida, I just can't get through this without laughing. These are ridiculous. Matt Gaetz is going to be nominated as Attorney General. His nomination is under question. He's not even well-liked within the Republican Party, let alone outside of it. And the crowning achievement to me, I think, was on Tuesday, Trump said that he's appointing Pete Hegseth, who is a Fox News personality, whose main qualification is that he's a character on Trump's favorite TV show, Fox and Friends, as Secretary of Defense. So just a glorious, glorious team being formed here.
That's like me appointing Elliot Stabler head of the Ministry of the Interior or something.
it's like the Justice League coming together. Superman, Batman, all the greats are going to be running an amazing team. And things just keep getting better. I think the important thing to understand is that it's morning in America. Spell that however you want, but we're on it, baby. We're coming back.
Well, Derek, thank you for giving us the news, and everyone, please consider liking, subscribing, and above all, subscribing with money to the show. We really need it to keep on going. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend 400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's BARTESIAN.com/cocktail.